Hi, everybody. My name is Hank Johnson, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
And I just spilled my coffee all over the table. And that's why my wife never used to like to take me anywhere. And I used to drink. I drank too, like the rest of you guys. I know I don't look like it tonight with a boot in the ear and everything, but I did. And I drank a lot for a lot of years. And I wouldn't be here except that my wife thought she was an alcoholic, and she went to AA. And I thought it was ridiculous that she would go to AA. Hell, I drank 10 times more than she did. And I sure as hell didn't need it. And I had been to a meeting one time prior to that, a couple of years before that happened. And it was one of these meetings where they give out chips. And in Southern California, they give out chips a little different. You know, all over the country, they give them out a little bit different. And in Southern California, they give them, this meeting that I went to, they give out at the beginning of the meeting. And the guy said, is there anyone here in his first 30 days of sobriety? If so, come up and get a chip. So this guy came up and, you know, my name's Joe Blow and I'm an alcoholic and I'm really proud to get this chip. And I know this is a spiritual program that I found God when I walked through the doors of AA, and it's the lights in the eyes of the people that just turn me on and keep me coming back to these meetings. I just love every single person here. You know. Just before I came to the meeting tonight, I got a call from my employer, and he's made me general manager down at the plant. Just a wonderful, glorious way of life. And for all you newcomers, keep coming back. We love you. And I thought, oh, jeez. And made me a little uncomfortable, I'll tell you. And then, anyone else? Yeah, here comes this little lady and ran up. Yeah, my name is Mary Smith, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm really proud to get this chip, and it's been the best 30 days of my entire life. And, I know that this is a spiritual program that I found God when I walked through the doors of AA, and it's the lights in the eyes of the people that just turn me on and keep me coming back to these meetings. And I just love everybody. You know, hate is no longer a word in my vocabulary. I not only love alcoholics, I love everybody in the whole world. Just a short time ago, my children, when they look my way, had fear in their eyes. Now when they look at me, they have a look of respect. And I've noticed lately that my husband is looking at me with renewed interest. And it's just a wonderful, glorious way of life we have here. And I wake up in the morning and I reach over and grab the hand of God, and we walk through the day hand in hand together. And for all you newcomers, keep coming back. We love you. I wasn't able to stay for the whole meeting that night. I needed a drink. And I went out and got one or 20. And my God. And so when my wife went to AA, I said, be careful. And just remember what the name of the organization is. It's Alcoholics Anonymous. Anonymous, that means no names. Don't give them my name, whatever you do. I don't want anybody knocking on my door trying to convert me. And so, you know, just prior to her going into to AA, we had been started back to group therapy again. We had gone to group therapy off and on for about 15 years, you know. And this latest thing was a couples workshop. And that's where married couples go and cop out on one another. And she'd tell all these people sitting in that room, there must have been 6 or 8 of them there, you know, and told them, why don't you tell them how you drank a fifth of vodka before I came home from work last night, you know. I said, well, why don't you tell them how you drank a fifth after you came home? You know, why are you singling me out? You know, you drink too. And I'd come out of those group sessions, you know. About the only thing I learned in group therapy or any other kind of therapy is that my mother-in-law had grave emotional problems. You know, if she didn't, why was she always at our house? Why didn't she get some friends? Why didn't she get a life? You know, why was she always there? And that's about it. That's what I learned. But I'd come out of those sessions, my guts would just be on fire, you know. And this therapist asked me one time, he said, you really drink as much as she says? And I says, yeah, I do. I drink a lot. So what? You know, they've never missed a meal. They've always had a decent place to live. They've always had medical attention, had bicycles, whatever they needed, clothing, you know, braces on their teeth, whatever they needed, they had. So I drink. So what? I need to drink. I have a pressure-packed day, and I need to have a drink when I come home at work from work at night. I didn't tell him that I came home about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, but you know, I need a few drinks to calm down. I got this pressure job, and he said, "Have you ever thought of quitting?" I said, "As a matter of fact, I have." And I see, I used to sit on the edge of my bed and play old phonograph records, you know. Billy Eckstein singing, "Who Can I Turn To?" You know, we were talking there. Billy Eckstein died just recently. It broke my heart. I used to listen to a lot of his records. But, you know, I used to sit and fantasize about starting tomorrow. Starting tomorrow, it's all going to be different. Starting tomorrow, I'm going to work 365 days in a row. I'm going to earn money every waking hour. From starting tomorrow, I'm not even going to drink for a whole year starting tomorrow. You know, and tomorrow was my password. My boss had a plaque in his office that said, "Today is the first day of the rest of your life." And I'd look at that plaque and I'd say, "Got that wrong. You know, tomorrow. Tomorrow's the first day. I'm sick today. I need to get home and get well, and then I can really hit it starting tomorrow. And starting tomorrow, a whole new life is going to open up for me. Starting tomorrow, I'm just going to stop all this nonsense and really get to work and change my life. And I'm going to work for a whole year without a day off, and every waking hour I'm going to be earning money, and I'm not even going to drink starting tomorrow." So when this therapist asked me, you know, "Have you ever thought of quitting?" I says, "Matter of fact, I have. I think about it all the time, really, you know. I think I will quit starting tomorrow, you know." And he said, "Have you ever thought of going to AA?" And I said, "I've already been to AA. It's some kind of a spiritual thing. It's a religious cult of some kind. It's okay for them. It's just nothing I'd be interested in." But I said, "I heard about some stuff called anabuse. In fact, I read an article about it." And I said, I'm going to quit, but I'll get some of that anabuse, and whenever I get an urge to take a drink, I'll pop some of that anabuse, and that'll deter me, because according to the article, if you drink on top of anabuse, you get sick. In fact, there's been cases where people have drank on top of anabuse and died, and according to this article I read. I think I'll get some of that. So he put me in touch with his doctor to get the anabuse. And I was told by the doctor's receptionist, "Don't drink for at least 48 hours prior to coming to the appointment." And I didn't drink. I went on the appointed day. I went to the doctor's office, and he called me into his office, and he said, "Is it true that you haven't had a drink for at least 48 hours prior to coming here?" I says, "That's right." He says, "You don't need anabuse." He says, "You're over the hump. You know, if you can go 48 hours without a drink, you never need to take another drink for as long as you live." Scared the hell out of me. And he went on and on and on about, you know, about drinking and alcohol and alcoholism. And he just would not stop. And he said that people that had the disease of alcoholism had character defects, and they refused to look at themselves. They refused to work on their problems. Instead of coping with their problems, they drink tonight instead, and they wake up tomorrow and they still got all their problems, only now they got a headache on top of it, and they keep repeating this over and over and over. It's a never-ending cycle. This guy was telling me my story. I just didn't recognize it at the time. And he just went on and on. He pulled a book from out of his bookshelf and started reading how people try to control and enjoy their drinking by switching from scotch to brandy and stuff like that, you know. Some real boring thing he was reading, you know. I know now it was a portion of chapter 3 is what he was reading. And I thought he would never stop. And I finally said, "Well, doctor, if you're not going to give me anabuse, then I guess I better go. How much do I owe you?" And he said, I'm going to tell you something. Due to the nature of your appointment here today, I'm going to tell you something I wouldn't normally tell my patients. But, you know, I think I'm going to share this with you. He said, the reason I happen to know about alcoholism is my wife's an alcoholic. And we've tried everything known to medical science. And we've tried psychiatry, and we've tried abuse, and hospitals, and tried everything. And everything works. It all works. As long as she's in the hospital, she don't drink. But it's after she gets out of the hospital, within a couple of weeks, she's drinking again. And he says, but she's sober now. She goes to AA. And she's got 7 months without a drink. And I thought, well, it's all very interesting, but, you know, I wasn't very interested in it. And he said, promise me something. Promise me that when you leave here today, he says, I don't recommend that you go to the hospital or anything. He said, you look to be in good health. He says, but drive by the Manhattan Beach Clubhouse and buy the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and get a meeting directory. And just go straight to AA. Don't go to any of those hospitals or any of that other stuff. And so I said, well, okay. He says, there'll be no charge for this call. And that's the only thing that guy said that day that impressed me at all. And I did go by and buy the book and picked up a meeting directory and threw it on my dresser and had another drink. Crazy doctor, you know, he could have had all my business if he'd have played his cards right. I probably would have wanted a few prescriptions too, you know. And I know they get a cut on all that. They just missed out on, you know, on a lot of money. And my wife had made a suicide attempt, and she had been with me at the doctor's, and she went back to the doctor, and she had completely destroyed this little place that we lived in a blackout, and then tried to commit suicide, and she woke up the next morning, and she was scared, and she went back to that doctor and asked him if he thought she was an alcoholic, because she didn't remember doing any of it, and he said he didn't know, but why didn't she go to some meetings with his wife? She'd be happy to take her. And so she came home and said, I'm going AA with the doctor's wife. And I said, oh my God, you know, be careful. And, so I said, so she went to AA, and that's the reason I'm standing here tonight. Cause she went to AA. I probably never would have come back. I don't know that for sure, but, you know, I just wasn't interested in AA. I didn't like it at all, as a matter of fact. But to be a good guy, every once in a while, I would go to a meeting with her. And I hated them. And it seemed like those same two people were at that meeting, or somebody took their script with them and talked how wonderful it is. You know? And I just hated those meetings. And I didn't listen to them. I refused to listen to the guy standing up here. You know, I thought they were experts, paid experts, you know. Experts in their field, you know, alcoholic lecturers, and I had a lot of experts in my life, you know, ministers and doctors and what they tell us, by the way, what they tell us is absolutely true. Everything they tell us, and we already know it. You shouldn't drink as much as you do. That's gonna ruin your health and ruin your family life and your job and everything, you know. I know all that. I just don't want to hear it, that's all. Yeah. And you know what an expert is, don't you? An expert's a guy that knows 100 different ways of making love and doesn't even have a girlfriend. Yeah. They've gone to school, they get degrees, they know everything about alcoholism. They absolutely know everything about alcoholism there is to know. But the one thing they don't know is what a drink does for a guy like me. You know, I'm aware that it isn't all right to drink. I mean, you know, I'm willing to pay that tab. I need to have a drink. It's instant relief for me. And they don't know that. They haven't experienced that. And that's why I wasn't listening to these guys up here I was out there sitting next to another alcoholic, rubbing shoulders with another alcoholic. And one time this guy said, I got 30 days tonight. I said, no kidding, how did you do that? You know, the guy up here had 20 years or something. I wasn't paying any attention to him. But the guy with 30 days, I wanted to know how he did it. And before, you know, I drifted around in AA for a while and visited AA. And I finally told my wife, I said, I've had it. I can't stand these meetings, you know. But I have found out that I'm an alcoholic. I know that, you know. But I'm not going to go to any more meetings. I said, I've had it with that. I can't stand these do-gooders. And who the hell do they think they're kidding anyhow? And how much they care and all that. And but I'm going to quit. And I did. I quit a little bit before Thanksgiving one year and in 1969. And I quit. And I didn't drink through the drinkingest part of the year, through the holiday season, you know, the Christmas season, when everywhere you go, they're pushing a drink your way. And I didn't drink. And the Saturday night after Christmas, she went off to a meeting. And I hadn't drank since before Thanksgiving. And here it is, the Saturday night after Christmas. And I got to talking to myself. And you know, I said to myself, you know, if you haven't drank since before Thanksgiving, and you didn't drink through the drinkingest part of the year, you know, you've made a mistake. You're really not an alcoholic after all. Anybody can do that. And so I went to the liquor store, and I bought a half a pint of vodka. And I no sooner got it back to the place, and I drank it, and I went, what the hell did I buy a half pint for? I went and got a fifth, and went and got another fifth, and I drank all Saturday night and all day Sunday. I closed a bar up in Los Angeles at 2 a.m., and I woke up the next morning. You know, I was late to work, but I knew you had to go in on Monday. You have to go in on Monday. If you don't go in on Monday, you're an alcoholic. I found out out right here in AA, So I somehow I just got it together enough, and I got to work, you know. And I was sick. God, I was sick. Because, you see, I hadn't drank for about 40 days. And I poured all that alcohol into my system all at once, and God, I was sick. And so I went over to the bar a little early that day. And I generally drank martinis at my lunch hour, but I went over a little early, and I was so sick that I had to have a glass of medicine. So I ordered a Bloody Mary. You know, that's what you order when you're sick. It's not a social drink of any kind. It's medicine. I had a glass of medicine. The guy got a big, tall glass. He put ice cubes in it. He put a shot of vodka. He put tomato juice, Worcestershire sauce, Tabasco, squeezed a lime in it, put salt in it, and he stirred it. I thought he'd never get that thing. Man, I'm sick. I need a drink. You know? And I picked that up with two hands, and I drank it straight down. And, man, it put the fire out. Jeez, make me another one. You know? And then I looked down. I had spilled half of it all over my tie. And so I went to the restroom. And I tried to clean the tomato juice off my tie and went back to the bar. And he said, did you want another Bloody Mary or did you want a martini? And I said, I'll just skip it. I went over to the coffee shop section of the bar and I had a sandwich and a glass of milk. And I haven't had a drink since. And that's a little over 23 years ago. And I can't tell you why I quit drinking that day for sure. You know, I hadn't even thought about it the night before. I was too busy drinking, you know, to think about starting tomorrow, you know. But I wasn't aware that I had even quit. But I had. I haven't had a drink since that day. And two or three weeks went by, and I didn't drink. And I found myself in AA meetings, you know, all by myself, without her, you know. And I don't know what I was doing there. And I was in some kind of a twilight zone or some fog I was in. I don't know. But I came out of a fog about two or three weeks later. And I realized that I had just completed 30 years of drinking. And I got this rotten wife. I got two of the worst children you could possibly imagine. You know, a pressure job. I owe money to everybody. It's all past due. And I don't mean last Friday, I mean due. Past. In the past. Yeah. And I got people calling me up all the time and they want their money. And when the phone rings, I jump clear across the room because I know it's a bill collector. You know, if anybody knocks on the door, I know it's the cops. I don't know what I've done, but I know I'm guilty. I'm ready to go. And now I can't even drink. What am I going to do? What am I going to do with the rest of my life? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. I hear these guys at AA meeting. I know how wonderful it is. I've been sober 40 days. I'm sober. I know how great you feel, you know. And who do they think they're kidding? And my life is over. You know, I'm struck down in the prime of my life with a killer disease, you know. I'll never be able to drink again. And I'll never, ever have any fun again. Ever. Sad. You know, it's sad. Very sad. And I'll never be able to go to a decent restaurant ever again. And I'm stuck at Denny's for the rest of my life. You know, if you go to a nice restaurant, what is it they want to know? Immediately, as soon as you go into a nice restaurant, what do they want to know? Would you like a cocktail before dinner? That's the first thing they ask you. You know, and you can't say, well, yeah, I'd like one, but you see, I've got this disease. It's of a twofold nature. It's an analogy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. If I take even one drink, I can't predict my behavior. If it wasn't for that, I'd sure have one. You know. I used to think you had to explain all that stuff to people. You know, I spent about 90% of my day back then explaining things to people. You know. That's one of the things I've been working on for the past several years. I'm trying to quit explaining. You know, I go sometimes 2 or 3 days without explaining. You know. But invariably, I slip. And I find myself explaining something to somebody, you know. And I always start from the day I was born. And I bring you up to date, you know, I want you to, all the pros and cons and ramifications of the problem. I want you to understand, you know. And then I realize what I'm doing. So I stop right in mid-explanation. And you know, I got some sad news for you people that are still explaining. They're not listening. You know, it turns out they're not listening to your explanation. No one's a damn bit interested in finding out why you haven't done something you were supposed to do in the first place. And I'm just trying to quit altogether. But it's not easy. And I used to just spend 90% of my day explaining back then, you know. And I'd go to these meetings, and I had 3 or 4 months of going to the meetings. I just hated it. I hated my life. And guys were taking the first and second step, you know, and they want to know what step are you on? And I said, what step are you on? And they said, come on, step 2. Well, then I'm on step 3. I always try to keep at least one step ahead of them, you know. And then they want to know if I got a sponsor. And I had gone to a meeting one time before I got sober, and my wife's sponsor, the doctor's wife, said that you ought to take Hank to hear this guy. He's really good. He's really a good speaker. And he's speaking at an anniversary meeting, 25th anniversary in Hawthorne, California. It was an afternoon meeting, and it was in the wintertime sometimes. The football season was on. And I says, well, what time does it start? And he says, about 2. Well, when's it over? You know, about 3:30, something like that. Well, the Rams are playing on TV, you know. And he says, well, you know, she said that he would really be somebody you should hear. And I says, oh, okay, I'll go. And I can at least catch the second half, you know. But we're not hanging around talking to anybody afterward. So I went, and this guy Clancy was talking. And he got up there and told a story. You know, I hadn't laughed for quite a while, and I heard him talk, and he's a marvelous speaker, as most of you already know. And God, he made me laugh. You know, I didn't laugh. I had trained myself all my life. You don't laugh, and you don't show any emotions to anybody, ever. You know, it's not cool to show how you're feeling to anybody, and I never did. You know, I could go to jazz joints and they're blowing these famous musicians, you know, playing saxophones and trumpets, and all the squares were snapping their fingers and tapping their toes, you know, and I'd look down on them and I'd sit there, not move a muscle, have a cigarette in one hand and a drink in another, you know. And if somebody told me a joke, I'd say, if it was funny, I'd say, you know, that's a funny joke. I had trained myself. And about the only time I laughed is if I see somebody fall down and hurt themselves, you know. And this guy started talking, and he was really funny. And I laughed, and at the end of his talk that day, he said, you know, of all the things that bothered him, that's still bothering him, were the things that he hadn't done. He seemed to be able to get over the fact that he had done all these bad things, drunk and sober. But he was having trouble with the things he hadn't done, the sins of omission. And geez, he nailed me, you know. And I listened to that, and that's the first speaker I identified with. You see, I was listening to the stories, and I never did any of that stuff. I never had fights in bars or cracked up cars or anything. You can't get in much trouble sitting on the edge of your bed drinking, I'll tell you that. So I didn't identify. But when he started talking about the things he hadn't done, he really nailed me. And you see, and I thought right then, geez, you know, I should have been a better son. I should have been a better husband, you know, a better father, a better employee, a better friend, you know. I should have been at all those things. I've never done anything. I just sat around and drank. That's all I've ever done. Criticized people. And, God, I left that meeting and I was really upset. I don't know about you, but when I was new, before I got sober, I couldn't stand to hear the truth. Not the truth about me. I'm not ready to face the truth about me. It really got me, and I couldn't wait to get out of there and drink. I had to drink right away, because he had stirred up my feelings. You know, I had trained myself for years and years not to show any feelings, but he really got to me. And I floated around in AA for a couple more months, and finally I met a guy who was being sponsored by Clancy, and he said, you ought to get him as a sponsor, and so I did. And I asked him to be my sponsor, and he said that, well, why don't you come down to my office on Monday and we'll talk about it. And so I said, okay. And he worked on the east side of Los Angeles then at a manufacturing plant. He was a PR man or advertising manager or whatever. And so I got in my car. And you know, see, I'm the world's greatest procrastinator, you know. Drive around with an empty tank, you know, looking for a bargain for gas, you know. I was on my way to the freeway and I was gonna pull in and get gas. Oh, I can get gas down the street here, it's cheaper. And I finally was on the freeway, you know. And I had to drive about 30 miles and on fumes. And my two front tires were ready to blow out because I didn't, you know, I needed tires. And I finally made it. And I said, you know, I don't know what's wrong. There's nothing really wrong with me, Clancy. I said, I just postpone things, that's all. And I said, you know, it's just, I drove down here on fumes. I said, I got the money, I can buy gas. I got two front tires that are blowing out any minute, you know. And I said, I don't know why, I just don't take care of it. And he says, I'm going to give you your first direction as a sponsor. And he got a pad out, you know, and he said, number one, when you leave here, stop at the first gas station and fill up, regardless of what brand they're selling or how much per gallon. And he said, then ask them if they sell tires. And if they sell tires, buy two front tires. And three, get a sandwich, you know. And four, call me and report in. Let me know you did it. And, you know, I did that. You know, I went and I bought gas and I got a couple of tires. I had a hamburger and I called him. Well, I did what you told me to do. And he said, that's great, kid. Go back to the office now and do some of that back paperwork. And that was it. Hung up and he was my sponsor from then on. And I don't know why I gave him the power that I gave him. I'm not sure why, you know, but I did. I actually turned my will and my life over to the care of my sponsor. I know a lot of people, it's almost like taking the third step. I know Clancy isn't God, but sometimes I think he thinks he is. I'm telling you something. There was this, you know, all kidding aside, there's no one kinder on a one-to-one basis than Clancy Emerson. He's gruff and tough and everything, but there's no one kinder on a one-to-one basis. And thank God I met him. I don't know if I'd be sober today if I hadn't met him when I did. And he gave me a lot of things to do. You know, he kept me busy so I stopped thinking about myself. I was always thinking about myself and the trouble I was in and all that, you know, and financial trouble and all kind of trouble with my wife and the children and the job and all. And I was always thinking about myself. And he gave me things to do that I would stop thinking about myself. Now, one of the things was I was over at his house on a Saturday and he said, Hank, would you mind doing something for me? No, I'll do anything. And he says, my speedometer has 99,997 miles. And he says, would you mind driving my car around the block a few times to where it's all nines? He says, I'll do that. So that's what I did. Yeah. I drove a car around the block, you know, so all the nines were even. So that he could take his little kids, they were little kids then, he could take them in the car, and they could all watch all the numbers turn. But you know, now what's that got to do with sobriety? What's that got to do with, you know, everything? Because you see, I stopped thinking about myself for about 10 minutes or 15 minutes. And I concentrated on something else besides myself. And that's the kind of stuff that I've been done, that I had to do. And I know I called him one time. And I says, Clancy, you know, I'm not going to be able to go to all these meetings you want me to go to. I says, I just realized that there's something, I have some deep, dark psychological problems that I just don't know. They're unnamed. I can't tell you what they are. But I'm going to have to get a psychiatrist. I'm going to have to make an appointment. I'm going to have to go into therapy. I'm sober now, and I'll really be able to get into it. I'll find out what's really wrong with me. He says, where are you? I said, I'm at home. And he says, well, it's 10:30 in the morning. He said, I'm already at work. You've called me at work. Said, there's nothing psychologically wrong with you. You're just not where you're supposed to be right now. Get in that car and go to work. And when you get there, you'll be a little embarrassed. You know, when you walk in late, you'll be a little embarrassed about it. But after 5-10 minutes, that'll blow over. And you'll be where you're supposed to be. And we'll talk about the psychology later, you know. And so I went to work. And I was embarrassed when I walked in. And it settled down in about 5 or 10 minutes. And I called him and said, yeah, you know, you're right. I feel a hell of a lot better, you know. And he said, you know, and it turns out I don't have any deep, dark psychological problems. I'm just lazy. I want you to love me. I want you to respect me. I want everything. I just don't want to have to do anything to earn it. That's all. I want you to love me as I am, you know. And if you can't do that, well, if that's asking too much, that's tough then. We don't have a relationship. And that's the way I am. And so that's when I had to get busy. Because that's not, you know, as much as we have these wishful moments, they wish things could be different, they don't change because we wish them. They change because of the actions that we take here in AA. And so I got busy on the steps. Another thing, he insisted I go to this meeting. And it was held on Tuesday night in the Pacific Group. You'll find a lot of you have heard of it. And there was about 250 people going to it then. And we met on Tuesday night, and they had a format, 2 10-minute speakers, a coffee break, and a main speaker. And they picked the 10-minute speakers on the way in. You never knew, you know, when you're going to get tagged for 10 minutes. And so it was about my second or third time at that. And the secretary said, "Hank, you're the second 10-minute speaker tonight." I said, "This got to be some mistake." I said, "I'm new." You know? And he said, "That's okay." You know? I said, "Well, but you know, I just had the worst day of my entire life. I couldn't possibly, I don't have anything to share with anybody. I couldn't possibly do it." He says, "What are you saying? You pass?" I said, "That's it. I pass. Catch me in about 6 months. I'll be happy to do it." You know? And he said, "We don't pass around here, Hank." He said, "Not at this meeting. At this meeting, when you're asked to do something, we consider it an AA request. And there's no choice about it. You know, it's AA request. You never turn down an AA request." And I said, "Well, God, I just don't see how I can do it." You know? And he says, "Well, why don't you just go in and sit down and go to the meeting tonight?" He says, "You don't have to if you don't want to. But," he says, "next Tuesday night, why don't you find another meeting to go to?" And he says, "You can go to another meeting and be a spectator." And, you know, I have found that to be true. There's a lot of meetings out there. And I've been to meetings all over the United States. And there's a lot of meetings. There's a lot of spectators in AA. And they act like they got some kind of an option whether they read chapter 5 or not, you know, or give a 10-minute talk. This is life-saving stuff. We don't have any options. We got to do it. And I know there's guys sober for 25 years out there that never read chapter 5, but I don't know about them. All I know is about guys like me. I have to do it. And so I said, "Okay, I'll talk," you know. And so I got up there, they called me, the first 10-minute speaker, I didn't hear anything he said, you know. And then they called my name. And I didn't have time to prepare my talk. Had I known I was going to be a 10-minute speaker, if they'd have just given me a little bit of warning about it. I could have prepared something. I could have went to the big book and picked out these potent quotes to lay on you, you know, and all that. But I didn't have time. So I just stood up in front of these people and I told the truth. And I said, I hate AA. I hate being sober. And I don't know how much longer I'm going to be able to stay sober. You know, and I'm going to meetings every night, and I got a sponsor and all that. But I says, I'm having all kinds of trouble with my wife and kids and job. And I really don't know. You know, I'm really think I'm a short timer. And I whined and whined like that for about 10 minutes. Whined and cried. And then I sat down. Boy, they all clapped, you know. It was wonderful, you know. And I sat down. And then they had the coffee break. And then the miracle happened. That's when the miracle happened for me. Because you see, about 250 people that just came at me. You know, I just had unconditional acceptance from about 250 people. Unconditional love from 250 people. It was overwhelming. And I've never been so high in all my life as I was at that moment. And that's when AA started for me, right then and there. And to my knowledge, I've never turned an AA request down from that time on. And I've done everything, you know, just like all the rest of the people who stayed sober. I've done everything, made coffee, secretary, you know, just do everything you're asked, and that's how you stay sober. And I've done it, and I've managed to stay sober for a little over 23 years now. But it wasn't all fun and games, you know. And I figured I'll stay sober for 6 months, you know. And I won't say anything at home. You know, I won't start any arguments or anything. You know, I'll just play it cool, and I won't criticize the food or anything. You know, because I can't afford to split up now. Because we used to split up a lot, and I don't want to split up now. And I'll stay sober for 6 months. At the end of 6 months' time, I'll have so much money because I'm in sales, and I'll make a lot of money now that I'm sober. Then end of 6 months I'll split, and I'll either go to San Francisco or Las Vegas and get a job bartending. You know, and I didn't know for sure if I'd go to San Francisco or Las Vegas, but I was kind of leaning towards Las Vegas. And 6 months came and went, and I had forgotten the promise that I had made to myself, because you see, everything changed in just that short period of time. And I didn't want to go. And my wife and I had some rough years, but we hung in there. You know, after about 2 years of sobriety, I came home one day and she said, "This is it." She said, "I'm leaving. You know, I can't stand it. This isn't any better than it was when we used to drink." And she said, "So I'm leaving. I don't know what I'm going to do, but, you know, the kids are grown now." And I said, "Well, geez, you know, shock to me." And I says, "Well, you know, I don't want you to go, but I understand if you have to go. I understand that." And when I said that, I got this feeling in the pit of my stomach of strength. You know, I felt strong. Because you see, what had happened to me, that I had become autonomous, self-supporting through my own contributions. I'm not talking money now, I'm talking emotions, that I knew that I would be able to live without her or anyone else. You know, that I could live in AA, the fellowship of AA and the friends that I had made. And I told her, "I don't want you to go, but if you have to go, you do." And well, long story short, she didn't go, and we were able to, through the years, we did okay. And so after several years, we decided we were able to buy a house. We knew we could never buy a house again. But right after I had taken my my fifth step and my sixth and seventh, and I was on my eighth step. Some guy walked up to me at the meeting and said, "You know, Hank, a lot of people in AA, a lot of alcoholics, he said, we spend money just like we drank, completely out of control." And he says, "We're going to have a meeting at my house next Monday, four or five of us. We're going to come to my house," and he says, "We're going to take a fearless and moral financial inventory of ourselves." And he says, "We just thought maybe you'd like to come." I don't think so, you know. And because, geez, I owed money to everybody, you know. And I was wearing tailor-made suits, you know, and expensive shoes, you know, but holes in my socks and no shorts, you know. I was all front, you know. And so he wanted me to come there, and he says, "Bring your checkbook and all your bills, and he said, and bring your pay stubs too." You know, I didn't want to bring my pay stubs. I didn't want to know how much I really made. You know, I was kind of given the impression I was doing a little better than I actually was. But I did that. I went to his house, and we made a list of all my bills. Made a list of all the expenses, the rent and the gas and the lights and the water and the food and all that stuff. Made that and totaled that up. Well, that was damn near all of that. That's what I made. Just barely covered those expenses. Then we made a list of all the bills that I had. I brought bills there. I had two drawers full of them. You know, I brought a stack of bills that high. And by the time we got through sorting those things out, the duplicates and triplicates, you know, I had cut my debt by 2/3, you know, just by facing it. You know, I don't know about you, but I carry this stuff around in my mind, and I build this stuff up to where it's just impossible to do anything about it. You know, I really, you know, it was only a third as bad as it I thought it was. And it was pretty bad anyway. And there was no way I could be able to do it. So we wrote letters to my creditors. And we said, "I fully acknowledge that I owe you this money. However, I'm unable to pay as previously agreed upon. Please accept the $10 check I've enclosed. And I will be sending you $10 a month until my financial picture changes. By return mail, or sometimes by telegram, unacceptable. If full balance isn't paid immediately, action will be taken." But you know, not one of those guys took any action. They cashed the $10 check instead. And I sent them $10 every month. And you know, it took me 3 years to get current in my bills. I don't mean paid off. I mean current. And the day that happened was a big, big day in my life. I felt more like a man that day than I've ever felt in my entire life. Because you see, I could walk down the street and look everybody in the eye, and I didn't owe them anything. Or if I did owe them something, it was current. And what a freedom. I had been set free. We went along, we bought a house, and then we looked at some property up in the desert, and we're going to buy a second house, for God's sake, and have a weekend house, you know. So we bought this place up in the desert, and we decided we're going to retire up there, and in the north of Los Angeles, the Antelope Valley, bought this acre of land on a nice house there, you know, and everything. And I was able to transfer my job up there and everything. It was just great. And a month or so after we moved in, my wife came to the office, and she had just been to the doctor. And she said, "The doctor just told me I got lung cancer and I'm going to die in 3 months." Great, you know. What's the use of planning? Why plan anything? Nothing's going to work out. I don't care, you know. They say all this stuff, but, geez, here we've been sober for all this time. You know, things ought to start getting good sometime, you know. And what's the use? I'm afraid I didn't take that news very well. But I went to my meeting that night. because you go to your meeting. If it's meeting night, you go to your meeting. Whether you feel good or you feel bad, it doesn't matter how you're feeling. If it's meeting night, you go to your meeting. I heard some guy by the name of Don N. from Fargo say that if it's meeting night, you go to your meeting. And the only excuse that you have for not going to the meeting is if there's a death in your family, yours. Otherwise, you go to your meeting. And so I went to my meeting. I had been trained that way. I went to my meeting that night. And I don't know, but I never have had the feeling that I really worked these steps the way you're supposed to. You know, I've been in discussion groups, and you guys all sound like you really got a grasp on them, you know. And I've taken them, but I just didn't quite feel like I, you know, had done them. I wasn't quite as spiritual as a lot of you guys. And so I just felt a little uneasy the way I had worked the steps. And I went to that meeting that night, and at the close of the meeting, they read on page 164 that little bit, you know, where it says, "Ask in your morning meditation what you can do for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order." You know, and then it goes on to say you can't transmit something you haven't got and all that, but your own house has to be in order. And I said, that's it. My house is in order, you know. And I realized, you know, that everything that needed to be said between her and I had long been said, you know. We had talked all that stuff over. You know? I had long since paid off all those bills. I had become dependable over a period of years. I had become responsible. You know, when I said something, you could pretty much make book that I was going to do that. And I was current in all my affairs. Sometimes they ask, "Hank, what is it that you've got from AA?" You know, sure, you got your sobriety and you got your good health, but what have you really gotten from AA? You know, what I got current. I got current in all my affairs. I'm not carrying 1969 around with me anymore. I'm not carrying 1975 around with me anymore. Or 1990. Or yesterday, even. See, my job is to stay current, you know, and keep my house in order. And sometimes I hear people talk about all the meditation they make. By the way, I've got to do this meditation thing tomorrow, 11-step tomorrow, you know. And I can tell you, save you a trip, you know. My morning meditation has boiled down to just a few words. And my morning prayers, you know. I just ask, I thank God for another day. And I ask if I can be of any help to anybody, you know, point the way. And then I ask God, what's next? And I go through the day doing the next indicated thing all day. Whatever's next. Everybody knows what's next. That's what to do. You know, and they want to know, what can I do? You do what's next. And that's God's will for you, by the way, to do whatever's next, I think. And so I go through the day doing what's next. And if I can go through the whole day doing what's next and not postponing anything until tomorrow, then I come home and I have dinner and I go to a meeting. And when I get home from the meeting, I can lie there in bed and I feel spiritual. You know, it's a spiritual feeling for me when I know that everything's been done. And I don't have anything in the corner of my mind thinking, oh, geez, I should have done that. I wish I would have done that, you know. Well, my wife lasted more than 3 months. She lasted 5 years because by then she was used to taking direction too. And she did what the doctor said, and she lasted 5 years. And she wanted to come home in 1986. She was in the hospital almost that whole year, and she came home for Christmas and wanted to be home for Christmas. And January the 1st came, and that was her 16th AA birthday. And I had bought a chain with a number 16, you know, on it, and I kind of dangled it in front of her on the January the 1st, 1986. And I think she seemed to light up a little bit. Maybe it's my imagination, you know, but anyway, she kind of acknowledged that it was her 16th birthday. And she had long since lost the ability to communicate. A few days later, a couple of weeks later, actually, she passed away. And I'll tell you something. Even if, I don't care how prepared you are for something like that, it's still a kick in the solar plexus when it happens. When it happened, it was a good thing. She needed to go But, you know, you try to figure out what God's will is. What is God's will? How come? You know, I smoked twice as much as she did. I drank 10 times as much as she did. How come she's the one who got sick and died? How do you figure that out? What does it all mean? You know, what's God's will? What's God meaning here, you know? And you can drive yourself crazy. I can drive myself crazy trying to figure out what it all means. And I found out that's not really what I want to know. You know, I don't want to know what it all means anymore. I got to learn how to accept life on life's terms, and that's what I've been doing. You know, and I want the experience of being alive. That's what's happened to me here in AA. I've had the experience of being alive. I haven't had to drink to dull my feelings or take any pills to dull my feelings. I experience life. And, you know, if you're alive, it isn't all good. Some bad stuff is going to happen to you. But, you know, I've been able to cope with that bad stuff. There's a friend of mine, Dick T. in Los Angeles, that he says, you know, we learn here in AA to cope. He says, but there's nothing in the big book that says we have to look good while we're coping. And that's the way, that's what's happened to me. I've been able to cope. I haven't had to drink. And so when she died, you know, my life's over again. I don't know what to do. At least I don't have to stand up here tonight and say, geez, if only I would have said this. I wish I would have said that. I did that. I don't have to do that. I can close the door on all that, all those years. And it's okay, you know. But now what am I supposed to do? Two or three months went by, and I was going to meetings, and the people in AA, both the men and the women, pulled me back into the land of the living, to the world of the living. And I had been dealing with death for so long. And I'd see a lady, you know, that I think, gee, that'd be a nice lady to go out with, you know. And she wouldn't go out with you. What makes you think she'd go out with you, you know? Says, well, why don't you call her and see, you know. And I call her, would you like to go out? Sure. Oh, jeez. Now what the hell am I going to do, you know. I don't know anything about relationships. I've been married all my life, you know. But I went on those things. And all those feelings of inadequacy and fear and all that stuff came back to me. All the feelings I had when I was 16, 17, 18 years old came rushing back to me. You know. And I remembered why I started to drink in the first place. But I was bound and determined to get through this episode in my life without drinking. And I did. And I went to speak in Charlotte, North Carolina. And I met a woman there that I had met 10 years ago in Madison, Wisconsin. She was married then, and I was married then, and we just met briefly and friendly, you know. And there she was in Charlotte. And so we started corresponding. And one thing led to another, and I went to Charlotte. And all this, you know, started. You know, sometimes I'm from Los Angeles, and I know a lot of people there. And all, they, Hank, why have you moved to Charlotte, North Carolina, for God's sake? And I said, well, there's a lot of history there. You know, you're only 400 miles from Washington, D.C., and I got the Civil War battlefield, and it's just very, very interesting, you know. And I was telling people that for a while. And finally I said, why don't you just say it, tell the truth? The truth is, Linda lives in Charlotte. That's why I went to Charlotte. And I live there now. And I love being there with her. And we have a good life together. And we've got a lot in common. She's sober for 11 years. And she's had her ups and downs, and I've had mine, and we're doing all right. So my son, you know, geez, I better get off here pretty quick. No, I still got my son used to look at me real funny back when I was drinking, you know, and he was 16 or so, and I would give him lectures about, you know, how the hell do you expect to amount to anything? You know, I'd stand there in my pajamas with a bottle of vodka in my hand, ask him, you know, if you don't shape up, you know, if you don't apply yourself in this world, my son, you know, I'm really worried about you. He'd look at me funny, and I'll be damned. When he was 21 years old, he turned himself into AA. And on May the 27th, just a couple of months from now, he's coming up for 20 years of sobriety. My daughter has a son, and he's 26 years old now. I can't believe I have a grandson that's 26, but he is. He's got 8 years of sobriety. And up until the time I moved to Charlotte, the three of us used to go to the Pacific Group, which has now changed to Wednesday night, and there's 12 to 1,500 people there every Wednesday night. And the three of us used to go to that meeting, celebrate our sobriety together. Sometimes they say there's no big deals in AA, but they're wrong. That's a big deal. It's a real big deal. And we went up to Seattle to the International Convention, and they invited me to sit with them. And I didn't even ask them. They just said, hey, Dad, why don't you sit with us? You know? And so we sat there with 46,000 other alcoholics. And we sat right by a passageway, and people walking by, and I don't know, hundreds of people said hello. You know, between the three of us, we knew everybody there practically. You know? And I sat there. My son was on my right, and his Al-Anon wife, and my grandson was on my left, and his then AA fiance, who is since married, and I'm going to be a great grandfather pretty soon. And we sat there. I don't know what was said. I didn't hear anything. I didn't hear a damn thing at that open meeting. There was 46,000 people. I just felt the electricity charge through me. I had a spiritual experience. You just can't get there from where we started 23 years ago. You know, they weren't even speaking to me. I was ashamed of them. And they were ashamed of me. And we have a loving relationship now. You know, my son is married now, and he's got a rotten wife and two terrible children. You know. Yeah. But he seems to love them, and so I do too. And I'm really a lucky guy. I get to come here. You know, it's really like old home week here. I know probably 50 people, and I don't know a lot of people in this audience. Been here before. And it's wonderful to see you all. And I just feel terrific. It's really an honor to be asked to speak at this convention here. About the only thing I know for sure about AA, the only message that I can really give you, they explain AA to you is what happened to me. What happened to me is I found out that this really is a spiritual program. And And I know that I found God when I walked through the door of AA. And you know, it's the lights in the eyes of the people that just turn me on and keep me coming back. Thank you very much.